G'day to you, wherever you are in this wonderful world that we live in. I'm located in Perth, Western Australia, and it's coming into springtime here and the early afternoon. For some of you, it'll be heading in towards your autumn, beautiful colours of that, and it's a real pleasure to be with you wherever you're from. You don't have to adjust your sets. You'll notice behind me here that this looks bright yellow. That's because it is. It's actually a whole wall worth of whiteboard, and we'll probably throw some pieces of info up there for you as we get cracking. So let me just tell you a little bit about this survival work that I did, because that'll help to locate me both geographically and I guess in terms of how I think about embodiment and about the topic of reality. So I'm just going to quickly jump into share a screen with you here, and we can show you a bit of that stuff. So we did survival courses in the Pilbara of Western Australia, and this is typical scenery from there. So it's a very arid area. The typical annual rainfall is less than 7 inches, and it's characterized by some really wide open area and then big river systems that run through. Some of those rivers are really, really huge when they're flowing, but they typically only flow for around about a month of the year, and the rest of the time they're dry. We used to run a 10-day survival course there where we'd give people a soapbox-sized survival kit. It was designed specifically to fit in your pocket, a couple of litres of water to start, and pretty much the clothes that they were wearing. And that was how they started. They would walk for 10 days through this landscape, looking for all their own food and water as they went. And they'd cover around about 200 kilometres. National Geographic came and filmed it in 1999. And they said it was the toughest thing they could find anywhere in the world in the realm of survival outside the military. And basically the difference between what we were doing and a military survival exercise is the military always combines it with escape and evasion, because the only time they need it is if they're stuck behind enemy lines. And that definitely adds an element of pressure. People are trying to catch you while you're still trying to do all of that. It's really important to make the distinction between this and living on the land in the way that Indigenous peoples have for hundreds and thousands of years. It's about how do we survive past a point of being lost or stranded and stay alive long enough to either get ourselves out of the situation or to wait for rescue, rather than how do we live on the land. And they're very different mindsets. So it's really sort of short burn, tactical environments. I like to say, we'll just give you a bit of a clue about the geography. So that's a map of Australia that's on your screen now. The little red circle around Perth, our Western Australian capital city, is where I am right now. And that photo is from the Pilbara region, which is up there in the northwest of Western Australia, around about 1,800 kilometres from Perth. So if you think about it in terms of, say, the UK and Europe, you would pretty much drive from the top end of the UK all the way down to the south of France to cover this a similar kind of bit of distance. So that's a little bit about that world. We'll just stop the screen share there. So all of that is a little bit like Bear Grylls, only real. Some of Bear's stuff is a little bit interesting. So for example, he'll tell you to drink your own wee to stay hydrated. Not a good idea. I thought as a survival specialist, I should find out about this. I should find out if it's a legitimate strategy or not. And so I wasn't keen on field trials, I'd have to say. I thought I'd ask people, what's your opinion about this, medical people? And so the medical people would tell me, no, it's a really bad idea that you drink your own wee, because you're already dehydrated, toxins out of your body, put that back in, it's only going to end poorly. And a doctor mate of mine actually eyeballed me and he said, you know what, Mike, you'd be better off if you drank someone else's. And I don't know about you, but that didn't really raise the appeal of the idea at all for me. Every now and then I'd get asked a really interesting question, which is, what's your success rate as a survival instructor? And it always used to make me laugh because I figured if it wasn't 100%, it'd be kind of false advertising, wouldn't it? You can imagine a group of 10 of you turning up in that Pilbara and me leaping out of the bushes and saying, "G'day, I'm Mike, your survival instructor. I've got a 98% success rate." And you'd be looking at each other going, "Bloody hell, I wonder who's not going to make it." So I would imagine at this point that we've got the group of people listening divided roughly into thirds. So I reckon there's probably a third of you who are thinking that there's no way you won't ever want to go anywhere near the outback with me. The outback, by the way, is an Australian term for that remote bush. There's probably a third of you who are going, "This is really fascinating, and where do I sign up? I'd love to have a go at that experience. It sounds fascinating. I'd like to test myself in that way." And there's probably about a third of you who are saying, "Well, it's interesting, but so what? What's it got to do with us? What's it got to do with our current context, our current reality?" And the session will really be about my observations from that time of instructing survival and what it means in terms of some practical and tactical tools to deal with reality, especially when it's not shaping up the way that you want it to be. Quick and easy ways to deal with pressure, to get clear, present, focused. And we'll look at a little bit of the survivor personality, those people that survive against the odds, and what makes up that kind of mindset. And it's very much about embodiment. They're people who are deeply aware of the situation that they're in and deeply accepting of the situation they're in, and yet still optimistically fighting for something different. So we'll explore all of that. Just before we get into there, I'd like to acknowledge Indigenous peoples globally, but particularly for the country I'm standing on. It's the Noongar Nation, the Whadjuk people. And I particularly want to acknowledge the gift that we've missed in this country, as in many others around the world. Colonisation's created a significant separation in those cultures, and it's created significant separation between those cultures and other cultures in this country. I think that we're slowly getting somewhere with that, and I'm going to be discussing some of that territory with the wonderful Sean Nanup, Whadjuk Elder, later. I think it's Monday next week, we'll be doing a discussion about what it means to be on country from our two different perspectives. The opportunity I reckon we've missed is that those Indigenous cultures were deeply embodied, so they understood land in a way, land and ecology in a way that is very difficult to understand from a modern white perspective. Deep, deep understandings of the rhythms and the flows of nature and birds and animals and fish and tides and times, and deep, deep culture. Deep, deep culture. I've had the privilege of spending a little bit of time with some of those people, and it's always been a blessing. So I'd just like to acknowledge that before we carry on. So when I wrote Thrive and Adapt, it was really about this link between people's circumstances, so the reality they face and their responses. And if you've been on the planet for any amount of time at all, you'll know that the circumstance doesn't dictate the response. That we can be side by side with another human being facing exactly the same set of circumstances, and one person will rise above them and find opportunities and create iterative and generative ideas and possibilities from the situation they're in. And other people will get at the other extreme into a victim tailspin where they're overwhelmed by the circumstances they face and they can't see any possibility of doing anything in there. And I got fascinated about that line. What sits on that line between our circumstances and our response? When we face a reality, particularly one that's a little bit unpalatable, what is it that makes some people able to respond really well, and what is it that shuts others down? That's kind of the place that I've spent most of my time over the last 20 or 30 years. it turns out that there's a whole personality around that. So this guy, Al Siebert, just holding up a book there, hopefully you can see that on the screen, Al Siebert's book, The Survivor Personality, he started a whole area of research in psychology that was around what are the characteristics, what are the traits of human beings that survive against the odds? And he looked across a real diverse range of human experience. So it was everything from dire medical diagnosis, lost and stranded in the bush somewhere, prisoners of war, victims of accident, illness, injury, all kinds of experiences where people essentially had their backs to the wall. And he said, what are the characteristics of those people that rise above? And a lot of it comes down to the mindset that sits on the line between reality or our circumstances and our response. So my plan today is to share with you three deeply tactical approaches to getting as grounded, clear, and present as you can in whatever your reality is, however challenging it is, and in that way to set yourself up to be a more embodied and effective version of yourself in the situation that you're in. I'd really like to interact with you. So thanks so much for the comments and what have you that have come up in the panel there, in the chat panel so far. But it'd be really nice for me, because I haven't got any feedback in webinar mode, to know that you're out there. So if you could just type a I can hear you, or a yes, or a carry on mic, or something like that in the chat, that would be great. And as was said before, if you've got questions, please put them up into the question part there. Great to see some people from Canada. Welcome. Alrighty, so let's plow into that. So part of the survivor personality is that they can handle paradox. And hopefully this is something that you've got a bit of a sense of over your life as well, where it's very, very rare we find ourselves in a situation where it's completely black and white. Sometimes it is, but mostly there's all sorts of shades of grey. And I like to think about paradox as either something where we're holding two truths that are equally valid, and while they're quite opposite to each other, they're equally valid in the moment, and we can hold them both as valid in the moment at the same time. And sometimes it's a choice. So it's almost like a continuum, a slider, where we get to choose where do I find myself? And I think one of the most powerful paradoxes when it comes to the survivor personality was described by James Stockdale, an American who was a prisoner of war during the Vietnam conflict in Vietnam. So one of the characteristics of the survivor personality is that they accept the reality that they're facing. I'm really noticing this. I don't know about you, but with COVID and as that's unfolding, there's a lot of people that are speculating about how this will end, what it will look like, when it'll be over. And in Australia at the moment, where we're relatively insulated from it, our governments have done a fairly good job of protecting our borders and keeping us relatively COVID-free compared to other parts of the world. There's people saying, oh, you know, I can't wait for 2020 to be over. As if that's a, you know, as if Christmas, Happy New Year, all of that will mark an end point. And it's an unrealistic view of the world. Well, I think it is anyway. It might be true, but I think it's unrealistic. It's likely that the scenario will roll on for much longer than that. And it's also unlikely that there'll be a clear and defined end point. And Stockdale was interviewed by Jim Collins in this fantastic leadership book, Good to Great. And I'm just going to read you a section, because the paradox of being able to face your reality is, while at the same time remaining optimistic, is a really powerful thing to be able to do. So Stockdale was imprisoned for 8 years, and he was tortured over 20 times, and he came out of that experience deeply physically scarred, effectively physically changed for life. And he and his wife wrote a book basically outlining their two sides of that experience. Collins said when he went to interview Stockdale that he couldn't get over the level of optimism that Stockdale seemed to hold, even though there didn't seem to be any hope. He said as he was reading his account, he was feeling depressed, and he wanted to ask him how that worked. And this is what Stockdale said. He said, "I never lost faith in the end of the story. I never doubted that not only would I get out, but also I would prevail in the end and turn the experience into the defining event of my life, which in retrospect, I would not trade." That's a very powerful, just think about that for a minute. So in retrospect, I would not trade this. I will make it a defining event in my life. It's a very, very powerful attitude in the midst of deep uncertainty, deep duress, and in the midst of receiving atrocious treatment that basically results in you being at least physically changed for life. So after Stockdale said that, they walked for a while down the country lane that they were walking along, Stockdale limping and arc swimming his stiff leg that never fully recovered from repeated torture. After about 100 metres, Collins asked him, "So who didn't make it out?" "Oh, that's easy," says Stockdale. "It was the optimists." "The optimists? I don't understand," says Collins. Given what he'd said 100 metres earlier, it doesn't sound logical, does it? He's this incredibly optimistic point of view, and he's saying the optimists don't get out. So he asked him more about it, and Stockdale says the optimists were the ones that said, "We're going to be out by Christmas," and Christmas would come and Christmas would go. And then they'd say, "We'll be out by Easter," and Easter would come and Easter would go. And then they'd say Thanksgiving, and that would come and go. And in the end, they died of a broken heart. After another long pause and more walking, he turned to me and he said, "This is a very important lesson. You must never confuse faith that you will prevail in the end, which you can never afford to lose, with the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they may be." So to me, that paradox is something that's, there are times where it's deeply difficult to hold those two truths simultaneously, a deep acceptance of your reality with a optimism that you'll be able to somehow influence them for good or make the most of them. And especially when we're facing circumstances sometimes that are deeply distressing, and where the reality may well be our ultimate demise. I'm just noticing in the comments there that there's some really interesting pieces of people's experience. You know, the reality of life is that sometimes it goes really, really well, and there's other times where it really serves us deeply, deeply difficult circumstances. And one of the most powerful things that we can do is accept whatever that reality is and take the gifts that it can give us, however difficult they seem to be to access. It's a really powerful mindset that sits between circumstance and response. So that's a mindset piece. Being present. Yeah, Thandy's just commented, "Wow, the power of being present with reality." Yeah, it's a deeply, deeply powerful thing to do. What's fascinating is, you know, this thing that I'm seeing with COVID, oh, it'll be over by 2020. It's the same as what Stockdale was talking about there, where, you know, we'll be out by Christmas, we'll be out by Christmas, we'll be out by Easter next year. I don't think it's a useful thing to do unless you have direct control over the circumstances themselves and can somehow define the time frame. In fact, I think it sets us up to be disrupted because of that factor that when it passes, it's actually an erosion of hope. So we need to find hope in things that are more substantial than arbitrary timeframes or denial of the circumstances and the reality that we're genuinely in. As we go through, you know, feel free to jump into that Q&A panel and ask us any questions that are along. And we're just about to dive into a tool that is about getting clear, present, and focused when you're in a pressure moment. So this is described in Thrive and Adapt. I call it guerrilla mindfulness. And guerrilla as in freedom fighter rather than big black ape. Guerrillas are typically outnumbered, outgunned, and outclassed. And so they rely on tactics that are quick and give the high return on investment. So mindfulness is something that I would imagine most of our audience has at least some connection with. And loads of evidence to suggest that it's absolutely, I would say, almost vital in our current age to have a well-established set of mindfulness practices. But it's difficult sometimes in a moment of pressure. You know, I might meditate, as I do most mornings, for around about half an hour, but then I'll go through my day making many transitions as I go along and, you know, from one thing to another. And often the transitions are quite abrupt, and the energy and the, you know, what I need to embody to bring my best self to the current situation might change quite dramatically many times during the day as I put on different hats, different roles, different responsibilities. And so I can meditate for 30 minutes in the morning, but by the time I've gone through several of those transitions, and particularly if I've picked up some less useful emotional energy along the way, you know, I might be frustrated or angry at things that have happened around me. It's kind of hard to connect back to that morning time. So that's one challenge. The second challenge is that in a moment of pressure, so if something happens right now that presses my buttons and gets me off kilter and leaves me shaking a little and a bit sort of out of sorts, our world's not set up in a way where I can go, oh, hang on a minute, folks, I've just lost my cool. Can I just take 20 minutes to meditate? I need to recenter myself. There's not very many environments where we can do that. And then the third thing is, if you're a really action-oriented person, I struggled with meditation for a long time because I'm action-oriented. I want to get out there and get hands-on and do stuff. So the thought of just sitting and the feeling of doing nothing is how meditation appeared at first. Is it, you know, why would I do that? Why wouldn't I go and do something? So guerrilla mindfulness is a tactic that sort of addresses all of that. If you're somebody that finds it hard to just sit and be present, it's a tool for them. If you're finding transitions challenging, it's a tool for them. And if you're finding a moment of pressure where you just need to reset and get more clear, present, and focus, it's a tool for them. So it's got three parts to it. And I'd like you to follow along where you are. So the first step is just to take three rhythmic breaths. And the rhythm is the important part, but if they're deep and slow, that's also good. The thing about rhythmic breathing is that it acts as a powerful switch in our physiology. The only part of our fight or flight mechanism that we can control consciously is our breathing. So three breaths actually switch that off. It won't necessarily stay off, but it'll switch it off pretty quickly. So just wherever you are, find yourself a comfortable spot, standing or sitting. Get anything that's in your hands out of your hands and just take three long, slow, rhythmic breaths at a pace that's good for you. I'd just be interested to hear from you in the chat there. How do you feel having taken those three breaths? What's going on for you having taken those three breaths? I'll just give you a moment there to throw a few responses in. That'll tell me you're listening as well, you see. So typically there's things like, yeah, immediately connected to my feet. Wow, that's great. Thanks, Sandy. What's really interesting is whenever I do that, even in environments that are quite calm, people will often say, I feel calmer. I feel more connected to myself. I feel sometimes you can actually feel your frontal cortex, the thinking part of your brain, opening up and becoming more kind of alert and aware. And that's just three breaths, three conscious breaths. It's a very, very powerful physiological mechanism. So that's step one of guerrilla mindfulness. Step two is to state as clearly as you can what your emotional condition is right now. And the important thing here is not to get into the detail of it. So as human beings, we're empathetic and we're also storytellers. So if I say I'm angry, for example, and you were listening to that, your logical response is to say, oh, Mike, why are you angry? You want me to share that with you. And I'm inclined to get into the story. It's all about this that happened and that happened. So if we get into the story, what typically happens is we go deeper into the emotion before we come out the other side. And that's not particularly useful in a pressure moment. There's definitely times and places for that. It's a very healthy thing for us to do, to process emotion thoroughly and completely. But for this exercise, it's really just about acknowledging how I feel. So in this very moment, standing here in front of you all, I would say I feel excited and a little bit anxious. And I wouldn't say anything more than that. So what's your current emotional state? If you had to describe it in two or three words. Someone's just said, no whining in adapting and thriving. Yeah, absolutely. That's pretty much how it goes. It's very easy for us to get into victim stories, isn't it? And it's not particularly useful. So someone's just said delighted and grateful there. Thank you. So that's part two. And acknowledging our emotional state helps us to just put it in the place that it needs to be and then move into an effective state energetically and emotionally for whatever we're about to go into. So step one is your three breaths, rhythm being the important part. Step two is to name your emotion. It's not always appropriate to do that out loud, by the way. And out loud is good, but it's not always possible. You know, if you're pacing around the corridors of your home or workplace going, I feel angry and a little bit confused, it might not be particularly useful. It might be better to keep that inside your head where it is just as effective, but for some reason, saying it out loud has more power. The third step after your emotional state is, what's your intention for right now? And that helps you to find the right kind of energetic state for this moment right now. And I'll give you a really quick example of a time that I used this. When I turned 40, I took myself for a 12-day solo walk in that same environment I showed you the photo of before. I went to a place I'd never been, and I got dropped off by a friend halfway between a small country town and another small country town just slightly north of the middle of nowhere. And my plan was to walk into a river system and then follow it along back to the highway and then come out of the exercise there. And I'd done literally thousands of hours of work in that kind of mode, but I'd never tested myself solo in that way before. And as I've walked up this hill away from the vehicle where they dropped me off, and it was just a little low hill, and I've turned and looked back down at where their vehicle is, and my friend and his two friends were packing up and getting ready to leave. And it was like a moment of, psychologically, it was the start line for that exercise where I realized this is it. You know, once they drive away, I'm genuinely on my own and no one's expecting me to the highway. And there was this real rush of fight or flight. So you get that sort of sweaty palm, tingly palm feeling, your feet get really active and your throat dries up and you can feel yourself getting really twitchy. And I just felt like running. And any survival instructor worth their salt, especially in a dry, hot environment like that, would say running's the last thing you should do, especially when you don't know where your next water's coming from. So it's not logical, but there's times where our emotional state really gets hold of us. And so what I did in that situation was I took those three breaths and I sat down and I said, how do I feel? I actually feel scared and I wonder if I have what it takes. And then my intention is to plan and execute my plan really well. So I just spent a bit of time sitting under a tree and calming things down and just getting ready to go. So we can use that in all kinds of ways. In a more modern workplace kind of context, I used it once when I was speaking in Sydney. I was in front of an audience of 600 people, and I often use my phone for timekeeping, and I keep it in my jacket pocket. And I pulled it out. I thought, I don't think I've set the phone to silent. So I pulled it out and checked, and I was right, I hadn't. And so just as I put it on silent, it rang, and I was literally being introduced on stage, a bit the way Thandi did just now. And I've answered the phone, and it was somebody I had a long-running invoice dispute over, and it was pretty much at the point of lawyers, and I ended up hanging up on them, and I was livid. I was so angry. And as I did that, I'm being called on the stage, please welcome Mike House. And it's like, So I've done exactly this. As I've walked up the stairs onto stage, three breaths, how do I feel? I feel frustrated and angry. What's my intention? My intention is to give these people the best of what I can give them in the 40 minutes that we've got together. So it's a very, very quick way to get yourself clear, present, and focused. Okay. So that's tool number one. If there's any questions about that, I'll get Thandi to interrupt me with those, but otherwise I'll carry on. I'll give you another tool. This one's for triaging environments and situations where you're experiencing pressure and you're trying to make sense of what is the reality and which bits of it can I actually have some impact on. And we'll use the big yellow whiteboard for that bit. So I'm just going to shut down this Q&A panel. There we go. Righto. So this tool is fantastically simple, as all the best tools are. It's just got three circles in it. And the inner circle is about the parts of the situation that you can control. If you've read Stephen Covey's book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, you'll recognize this as a version of something he presented there, but its lineage is actually much older than that. I think the mindset for this, from what I've researched, that, you know, there's certainly elements of it that are deeply woven into many, many indigenous cultures. And the ancient Stoic philosophers also had a lot to say about this kind of space. They didn't present it in quite this way, but their thinking was very much like that. So control is anything that if I take an action, I cause a direct result, or I can absolutely control that. It's 100% in my hands. And we'll give you an example of these. I'll just lay out the three rings first, and then I'll talk you through an example of each one. Typically, what's in the circle of control, I find a little bit liberating and a little bit terrifying simultaneously, because it's usually quite small. Some of the kinds of things that you... Okay, so Q&A is working again. Thank you. Good stuff. So the circle of control is usually quite small, and as I say, simultaneously liberating and a little bit terrifying to think that that's as much as you've got control over. But there it is. The second circle is the circle of influence. So influence is things where I can't directly control it, but I do have some ability to move the dial on it. So some examples of what might be in control. Things like how I think, the quality of the results I produce, how I rest, how I eat, how I exercise, the things I do to look after myself, my responses to other people, my attitude and demeanor, to some degree my reactions, although there's a line of fight or flight where that gets taken a bit out of our control. Breathing will get it back. This is usually the realm of us interacting with other people. So even if I'd like to think I've got control over someone else, it's actually never true. The best I can do is influence it. And we'll talk a little bit about tactics there. And then the last one is the circle of concern. So concern is, you know, I need to pay attention to this, because if I don't, there could be negative consequences, undesirable consequences. So I need to keep an eye on it, but I can't control it and I can't influence it. So let me give you an example. We'll work through it. Not all that long ago, a large cyclone crossed that coastline that we were, where we used to do survival work. And a bit like hurricanes and tornadoes and things like that in other parts of the world, they're quite destructive weather events. And it's pretty important for people to tidy up their immediate environment, get loose things battened down. So you can imagine a cyclone coming towards the coast with destructive winds forecast. The kinds of things that are in my control are my backyard. So I can go around and clean up and sort out the things that are loose, and I can put up storm shutters and all of those kinds of things to make sure that my place is as safe as it can be. When it comes to influence, if you were my neighbour and you had garbage all over your yard, there's loose tin and old car bodies and stuff everywhere, and when the storm hits, that's going to become flying missiles. I don't really want to live near that, but I can't control you. I can't make you clean it up. So it's a game of influence. I can see what I can do to get you to clean it up. But the reality of influence is that I pull a lever, it doesn't necessarily result in the outcome that I want. And a lot of us create stress for ourselves when we get this line confused. So if I feel like I should be able to control you, that will do my head in. Lots of us get really stressed and sometimes quite anxious because of our, you know, we feel the need to control other people around us. And because we don't recognize that it's basically an influence tactic that we're employing, we get really annoyed or distracted or sometimes even depressed if the outcomes are not the outcomes that we were looking for. So, you know, here we have a choice. It's like, do I influence this? And if I do, how do I influence it? So, you know, if you were my neighbor, some of the options might be I could lean over the back fence with two cans of beer and say, how about we have a beer together and I'll give you a hand to clean your yard up. And the person might go, yeah, great. Hop over the fence, Mike. That'd be awesome. I'd love your help. It might be that I have a word in his partner's ear and say, hey, look, you know, can you get George to clean the yard up? It might be that we write to the local government authority and say, can you send someone over to get heavy-handed with George and get him to clean the yard? There's lots of different ways we can approach influence. And if we're clever here, we actually choose tactics that will have the best effect. The circle of concern is the cyclone itself. So I can't, doesn't matter what I do here or here, the cyclone will come, it will cross the coast, there will be destructive winds. I could go down to the beach and spend my afternoon going, turn back, storm. You know, I could burn a heap of emotional and physical energy worrying about the storm, trying to make the storm do something different. And I can't control it. I can't influence it. But I do need to know where it is, how it's traveling, and the kind of impact that it will have when it arrives. So that's a really good... That's a really good way to triage situations. If you're facing a moment of pressure or a period of time with pressure, I find this a really useful way to kind of pull yourself back from overwhelm fairly quickly. You can quickly draw this up and go, what's in my control in this situation? What can I influence? What do I need to be concerned about? and I can manage that. And if it's just a general sense of, gee, the reality I'm in at the moment is all a bit overwhelming, there's so much of it, then I can put everything in here and make some really clear decisions about what I put in and what I put out. So outside of this circle of concern is everything. You know, we can bring things in here that really we don't need to worry about. And there's some things that we might bring in here and work really diligently on in seasons, and then at other times when our energy is less, we might push them out here. And for me, that's things like, for example, you know, I might work hard at influencing people around their environmental attitudes. The environment is in the circle of concern. In times where I'm personally pressured and it's difficult to find capacity, I might choose to move that out here for a while and not do anything here, just in the interests of containing my world a little bit more and feeling like I've got a little bit more control. That's a great question, Thandi. So Thandi's just said, shall we ask if anyone has a situation where they'd like to talk through using this model? We could certainly do that, or I can share with you one final tactic or tool, which I think is really useful in moments of pressure. So I'll start doing that. And then if someone comes up with something they'd like to work through this, ask any specific questions about a particular situation, we can certainly do that. And Shanti's just said, raise your hand if you're keen to volunteer for a bit of a chat. So we'll see how we go with that. So the last piece is to talk briefly about a human bias that we have. We have many biases. There's around about 100 that psychologists have identified over the years. And one of them is a bias called negativity bias, which means we give greater weight to negative situations than positive ones. And the research around this suggests that the ratio is around about 5 to 1. So it takes 5 positive experiences against 1 negative one for me to feel like, on balance, the environment or the situation I'm in is a positive situation. And I think this is really, really relevant in the world that we're in at the moment, where we're being pretty much constantly bombarded with news of all sorts of, you know, quite difficult and terrible situations unfolding around us. So it's very easy for us to develop a view that everything is negative because of that. It's a survival mechanism, really, because, you know, if we don't pay attention to the things that potentially could harm us, if we're ignorant of those things, then we're destined to repeat mistakes that are not particularly useful and helpful. But I think it's a real imperative for us in our modern age, and coming back to where we started, to the survivor personality, it's one of the traits of people who do well against the odds, is that they balance that negativity bias with gratitude. It's an incredibly powerful and simple thing to do, is to find things to be thankful and grateful for, regardless of how dire your circumstances are. And the reality is sometimes our reality sucks deeply, you know, that it feels as though there's not much to be grateful for at all. In my belief, there's always something that we can find that we're grateful for. So I'd personally finish this session with 3 points of gratitude myself, and I'd love if you shared a few things that you were grateful for in the chat as well. So for me, I'm grateful for 3 things as we stand here today. So the first is, I'm grateful for your time and your attention. I know with the world that we live in these days, an hour is a very precious slice of time, and I'm grateful that you've chosen to give this hour of your attention to me. That feels like a real privilege, and your time and attention has made my job a pleasure. I'm grateful for the opportunity to share some of the knowledge that I've gained over the years in ways that make a difference for people, that for me feels like living on purpose. And I'm really grateful to Thandi and to Shandi who welcomed me and set us up for this session before you all joined us. That made my life distinctly easy and a great and calm way to start. So thank you to you two for that, and to the organising group generally for the opportunity that this conference is. That's it for me, I reckon. If you've got questions or bits and pieces that you'd like to dive into, I'll hand that back to Thandi and she can moderate and manage our time a little on that, but more than happy to answer a question or two before we close if that's useful.
Thank you, Mike. I am super grateful that I got to host such an engaging speaker with some really fantastic practical tactical tools. Thank you. Also grateful to Shanti for your support and for all of those of you who've joined us today. We just a couple of things before we close. I invite you to join the, if you would like to continue discussions, you can join the coffee breaks through the portal. And you can also join our Facebook group. We have a private Facebook group to continue discussions. And the next speaker we have up on the Ecology and Research channel really focuses up on research. He is talking about, Dr. Amit Abraham is talking about mental imagery and embodiment in individuals with Parkinson's disease. I don't know if any of you have gone through the entire portal. It can sometimes be quite overwhelming, although I think it's possibly better to say it's awesome. And if you'd like to upgrade your account so that you can take this full library of presentations and digest them in your own time, please do so. To upgrade the account, you will also get a list of learning listings, will help you structure your learning. And if you're a committed lifelong learner like myself, you're able to then learn in a structured way at your own pace. It's also a fantastic way to say thank you to the awesome team who's put this conference together. And if you're able to do so, your upgrading of your account enables those who are not able to do so to have access to this incredible resource. Before we end off, I would like to ask you, I think we have a couple more minutes for any questions before we close off. Are there any questions from the conference?
Shanti's just said we actually still have 9 minutes, so we've got a little bit of time there. So certainly happy to take any questions or observations or comments.
Mike, there was a question earlier where somebody had looked at having gone through an experience and then having still nightmares from the scene. Have you got some insight into how this person could respond to that, or how could they learn to survive this?
Yeah, I think it's this is a challenging area, I think, and I don't know that I've got anything that's specifically useful. I'm certainly not a specialist in that area. I know that it can be very challenging when we experience things that are sort of at the extremes of human experience. You know, I work a lot with emergency services personnel who are often witness to some really gruesome human behavior and human experience, and it's very difficult to process that. For me personally, the times that I've been in situations where it's just very hard to clear my mind of the content and detail of things that I've witnessed, the two strategies that work the best for me are to tell the story as often as I can until it until it just feels like a story rather than activates all of the emotion. And sometimes that means many tellings and the telling can be arduous. But if you can get, I find if you can get to a point where you can tell the story without it having a profound impact in the moment anymore, I've found that useful. You obviously have to choose who you're telling it to. They need to be good listeners and people that aren't going to be impacted by what you're telling them too much as well. And then the second thing is just time in nature. Nature has a wonderful way of restoring all sorts of psychometric and biometric rhythms. Immersing yourself in that environment is deeply healthy. Whether it actually stops things like nightmares, I haven't seen anything specific about that, but it certainly helps us with our general physiological and mental regulation, which is all part of that picture. Someone's asked the question, where do you find water out in the WA wilds? And that's a combination of those river systems I was talking about up there typically have some permanent water pools. The quality of the water varies from absolutely beautiful to fairly sludgy. And then there's a number of trees or plants and plant roots where you can get water as well. There's often dew in our deserts here. And if you're well set up, you can catch that too. Someone's asked for a book list. So let me just quickly do that. Thrive and Adapt, there's a link to my website and you can get copies of that from there. Jim Collins' Good to Great, which is where the Stockdale Paradox came from. And Al Siebert, The Survivor Personality, were the three that I specifically referred to during this session. Have we got anything else out there? Just having a little bit of a scan. My pleasure, Greta. Is that enough for you? Did you need any of those again, or did you capture them? Beautiful. I'm not seeing any other questions there. Anything else from you, Thandi?
Well, I would like to say I really like your calling of these tactics guerrilla tactics. So I see myself now leaving the session as a guerrilla fighter in my own life and a survivor. Awesome to be learning from a survival instructor with a 100% success rate.
Yeah, it's important to maintain that.
Indeed. Then Joan has just let us know that she's doodled some notes and she'd love to show for a moment and email you later. Shanti is a way for you to show us Joan's doodlings or her notes. Is there a way to promote Joan to a...
Yeah, go ahead, Joan. I just made you, but just put you on spotlight.
Sure, thank you. I just realized that this might be backwards.
No, it's perfect.
No, it's perfect. It's beautiful. Well done.
Thank you so much. This is a fun way to interact.
Joan, would you mind taking a photo and maybe emailing that?
Absolutely. Happy to. Thank you all so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
It's a lovely point there from Anna, is that we can see these survival skills as in something as simple as falling down the stairs in daily life.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, for me, a survival situation is really any situation that you didn't anticipate that has consequences. And, you know, sometimes they're really short, like falling down the stairs, and sometimes they're long and grinding like COVID is for many people. So, for me, the tactics can be used across that full range of experience.
Marvelous. So as we come to the close here, thank you again, Mike. That was a really fascinating talk and really engaging. Thank you. And for as we close off here, Mike, your top tip for embodiment?
Well, I think the topic that we've really been in, which is to acknowledge and accept your reality. If you can do that, you you become part, a conscious part of whatever system you are currently in. And that's a powerful place to begin.
Beautiful. Reality is the gift.
That's it.
Thank you, Mike. And thank you all for joining us today. I look forward to seeing you in other parts of the conference.